all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Dwight S. Mears, retired Army major with a fascinating background. And Dwight, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we want to have you on. We're going to talk in this interview about some work you did regarding U.S. airmen in Switzerland who were interned during World War. But before we get to both of those, which you are a scholar in, I should point out to our veteran radio listeners that Major Dwight Mears retired, holds a degree from West Point, a Ph.D. From the University of North Carolina, a law degree from Lewis and Clark Law School. And if that wasn't enough, he's sharpening his research skills working on a master's in library science. Dwight, you just can't get away from academic studies, can you?
Well, I suppose not.
Well, let's start. Well, let's go way back before you got all these exalted degrees and academic experience. Tell us about growing up and why you thought, geez, I wish I could and maybe I can go to West Point.
Well, I grew up primarily in Oregon. I was born in California, but moved up to Oregon when I was pretty young. And so most of the time preparing for college, I was in Corvallis and Eugene, Oregon, and then didn't really consider the military until we started looking at college literature and realized that attending a service academy is a pretty good deal, both financially and in terms of, you know, having a guaranteed job and some experience that I think a lot of people respect. And so so I competed for a nomination and was given one by Senator Hatfield, who was one of our Oregon senators at that time, and then showed up at the military academy in the summer of 97.
Those 4 years there were unlike anything that you would have experienced back in Oregon. Tell us a little bit about the culture shock.
Well, it was probably greater for me than some. There are prior enlisted soldiers that end up at West Point. At that time, they were, I think, bordering on 20% of the class or something in that range. And those soldiers tended to be very much more prepared in the military aspect of transitioning into the military because they had already been there and in many cases had more experience than the cadets that were leading the training. And so I that was not me. I have had military service in my family, but it was at my grandparents served in the Army and the Navy. And so I didn't know either of them, because they were deceased when I was born. So I definitely had a bit of a culture shock. I was academically prepared, I think, but, as West Point is designed to do, it did shake me up a little bit.
Well, that is the goal. And upon graduation, you had the opportunity to move into aviation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I became interested in flying at some point midway through my time at West Point, and that actually intersected with some of the research I was doing on my grandfather, my paternal grandfather had served in the Army Air Forces and was a B-17 pilot. And I was already interested in becoming a pilot, and that was the closest relative that had done something similar to what I was thinking of doing. And so that kind of dovetailed into my existing interest, and I started doing research that led to later my dissertation.
Well, before we get into that aspect of it, just go ahead and wrap up your military career for us, some of the assignments and the works that you accomplished.
Sure. I went to flight school in 2001 after graduating. I had already earned a private pilot's license on my own. I started flying at West Point in little Cessnas and also some helicopters. But I earned my single engine airplane license, which helped me at flight school. And then I picked Kiowa Warriors, which are a small scout attack helicopter that's since been retired due to budget cuts and failed procurement initiatives. And so I served in Wheeler Airfield, which is near Schofield Barracks on Oahu, Hawaii, and then deployed to Operation Iraqi Freedom. Later, I transitioned into airplanes. I became a military intelligence pilot, which required me to go to intelligence training as a captain. And then I flew these modified King Airs in the Republic of Korea. And so I was a platoon leader in Hawaii and Iraq when I was a lieutenant. And then I was a company commander of a headquarters company in Korea while I was a pilot. And while I was there, I put in an application to become a professor at West Point on the basis of research that I had started some years earlier. And the history department at West Point was interested in that because I had pulled archival records from the United States and Switzerland. And so I already had wetted the whistle, so to speak. And so they agreed to send me to graduate school.
Well, let's dive into that. You've sort of wet our whistle here that, and this really comes out of sort of information about your late grandfather, Army Air Force Lieutenant George W. Mears, that you started diving into and took on a life of its own. Tell us about it.
Well, my grandfather had passed before I was born in the early 70s, and so I didn't have any information about him that, other than vicarious information, obviously. And it turned out, like a lot of World War II vets, he didn't, he wasn't entirely transparent with his family about what happened for the year or so that he was overseas. He basically dropped out of college in New Jersey and enlisted in the Army, went through infantry training, and then requested a transfer into the Air Corps and became a B-17 pilot. And this was in late 1943 when the Army Air Forces were taking horrendous casualties over Europe. And so he trained with a crew that was supposed to go to a specific bomb group that he was already assigned to, and they transferred him en route to Europe to a different bomb group because they had lost so many people on one raid. I mean, they lost like a quarter of their ships or something. And so he showed up right in the middle of a really bad period in late 1943 when the survival rate for people bombing continental Europe was not very high. And so I've seen statistics. It depends on the time period, but I think the average survival rate was something like 5 missions for some of these people at that time. And there was a less than 50% chance of surviving your tour, obviously, because at the time he showed up, you had to complete about 20 missions to rotate back to the United States and complete your tour.
And his B-17 was shot down in March of 1944. Pick the story up from there and tell us what happens to your grandfather.
Sure. So he was actually right on or about at the 20-mission threshold, depending on how you counted it, because he had rotated in with a few crews where he was not in his regular crew, and so he had accrued a few extra missions. And by this time, they were bombing Germany, so very deep penetration of Europe. And he was probably one of the more senior pilots, and his navigator also, who was a pretty important fixture of the crew, was one of the more senior navigators in the squadron. And so they were flying squadron lead, meaning everyone else in the formation was, you know, basing their position off of them, and they would have had the primary navigation responsibility also, because the lead ship kind of sets the stage for everybody else. And so they survived longer than average, from what I can tell. And then their luck ran out. So they had already ditched one B-17 over the English Channel because it had suffered so much damage that it was unflyable, or at least they couldn't do anything except keep it straight and level. And so they bailed out. They had also crashed another B-17 due to fog on a British airfield, and I think that was probably unrecoverable. So this was their third aircraft by March of 44. They were bombing an airfield near Munich, and they took hits from enemy fighters directly in the cockpit. And so they had, my grandfather had his control column shot away, and so he was unable to fly the aircraft from his seat. And he had another engine shot out, and a third engine, I think, was on fire on the same wing. And so if you've ever flown a multi-engine aircraft, it's bad news when you lose, two engines on the same wing. It tends to make the aircraft fly in circles, so very efficient.
But due to his skill and the whole crew skill and the limping along of the P-17, he's able to fly it out of Germany and fly it into Switzerland airspace. Now that,
yeah, I think he was probably lucky.
Well, we'll take luck, right? You'd think at that point, okay, that's good. But what happened when he crashed into around Zurich, Switzerland?
Well, so Munich is not far from the Swiss border, and so once they took these hits, my grandfather was stunned, and the plane went into almost a vertical dive from 22,000 feet to about 5,000 feet. So they almost just died. But somehow my grandfather changed seats with his co-pilot, who still had an operative control column, and he leveled the plane out, and they determined there was no way they could make it back to England, where they were based, because of the engines and the fuel, and it would just be picked off by fighters. And so they ended up charting a course to Zurich, as you already mentioned. And at least according to one of the crew members, the landing gear actually collapsed when they landed. That kind of a landing, when you have only engines operating on one side, you usually have to cut the power to get the aircraft to land straight, because otherwise you'd be in a crab as you hit the ground. And that's probably what happened anyway. And so the landing gear collapsed. The aircraft was pretty significantly damaged. My grandfather was slightly wounded from the shell exploding in his face, basically. And so they were taken into interrogation, and the Swiss sent them up to quarantine for a week or two in the mountains, and then they were transferred to a camp that had already been established for some Americans, as well as some Yugoslavs and some British troops that were interned.
And this
the Swiss
is,
had pioneered.
Yeah, this is this is the part that I was surprised at, which is now being held by Switzerland, in theory a neutral country in World War II, the internees or prisoners of war, I would have called them, were ineligible to be considered under U.S. law prisoners of war because they were being held by this neutral country. It just sort of seemed backwards. Were you surprised when you dug into this story and said, hey, these men in Switzerland aren't recognized as American POWs?
Well, it not really. What was difficult was just identifying what the controlling law was, because it wasn't being followed. And that's because the term prisoner of war is fairly ubiquitous. And even lawyers that were weighing in on this issue actually gravitated to the wrong, treaty law, actually. In this case, there was a law that had been enacted in the 80s to grant medals to former prisoners of war, but it required you to actually be a prisoner of war. And that's defined by treaty law, that the Geneva Conventions in this case says it's a very distinct category of combatant. You have to actually be held by somebody who's a party to the conflict, notably against you. And obviously this was a gray area, that these men were held similar to prisoners of war. The Swiss asylum guarantee that had been pioneered in the mid-1800s disarmed soldiers of belligerent powers and kept them for the duration of the conflict, similar to POWs, and that's so that they wouldn't be giving the other party a reason to attack them. They could say, we can, you know, offer asylum to these people and they're not going to be a threat to you any longer because we've now, you know, neutered them, so to speak. They don't have their weapons any longer. They're not going to be re-entering the conflict because of us helping them. But they never went so far as to write explicit protections for these internees because there had never been an instance up until that time. In this case, when they wrote the Geneva Conventions in the 1920s, the earlier version, they were based on World War I, and internment did happen in World War I, but not mistreatment. And so this was just an area that the law did not address. And when the United States had enacted this statute to recognize prisoners of war, they invoked prisoners of war as a requirement. And so you had to actually be held by an enemy or an opposing force who was fighting against you. That quickly became a problem.
The Swiss did not hold these internees, you know, in chalets. They were in internment camps, you know, barbed wire, patrol guards and dogs, horrible food and health conditions, right?
Well, it's a little more nuanced than that. Most Americans that end up in the country, and there were many because there weren't many places that you could land a bomber in the middle of Europe before the Normandy invasion. And so we had over 1,500 Army Air Force crews land in Switzerland due to combat damage, and a smaller number, over 1,300, landed in Sweden because of the neutral refuge that both countries offered. And a smaller number landed in Turkey, Portugal, Spain, and even the USSR, because with respect to Japan, they were neutral. And so some of the Doolittle Raiders ended up there, for example. But the Americans were not mistreated in general. The vast majority were just taken up and segregated in these mountain towns. They took my father to Ottobodden, where he was with these other nationalities that were not warring with the Americans, until so many crews showed up that they had to actually push them out to different locations. And so as a consequence, he was sent to Davos with the other American officers. And there were hundreds of Americans there by that time, by late 1944. And my grandfather made the decision that he may have regretted later to try and escape from Switzerland after the Normandy invasion, because once there was a U.S. presence in France, all one had to do was cross the border near Geneva somewhere, and you could get into U.S. lines within a few miles. And so by October and November of 1944, hundreds of Americans attempted to escape from these mountain towns where they were not heavily guarded, largely because they were isolated way up in the mountains. It was difficult for Americans to cross Switzerland when they were in the Alps. And a lot of them were fairly obviously not locals because they weren't dressed correctly and they didn't know the language. They couldn't get the rail passes. And so they usually utilized the assistance of Swiss citizens who were sympathetic to the Allied cause. And there were many of them, particularly the French Swiss, because they were culturally very close to France, which obviously was under occupation. And so a lot of these Swiss risked their own citizenship to get the Americans out. And my grandfather, unfortunately, was caught. And so he was intercepted crossing the border at Geneva, and they were not happy with him. And so he was sent to a punitive camp near Lucerne, and he was tried by a military tribunal in absentia, and so he was not allowed to attend his own legal proceeding and was sentenced to prison. So that's what happened to about 160 Americans.
You had the opportunity to complete this research both with work in the archives of, in the United States, but also in Switzerland, and develop a doctoral thesis on this research. And ultimately, that led to some legislative remedy. Tell us how that evolved.
Well, as I mentioned, I was interested kind of from a genealogy standpoint initially in documenting my grandfather. And then once I went back and turned this into my master's thesis and my doctoral dissertation, I had gone to the archives and I realized there was a bigger story here. And there were a lot of living Americans that were still around. And there was a very palpable stigma associated with being in a neutral country, especially Switzerland, because the assumption of anyone you would ask, including people who had served in World War II, was that this was just a ski vacation, that they were out, you know, on the hills yodeling and learning to ski and dating girls, and that a healthy number of these people must have gone there intentionally. It was like the theme to Catch 22, where Yossarian and his bunkmate Orr are always trying to get to Sweden. And obviously the motives there are illicit. You're trying to actually desert your forces and shirk your duty. And a lot of people assume that that's what these Americans did, or at least a healthy proportion of the 1,500 or so people that were there. And that turns out to be mostly untrue. There was never any proven cases where anybody actually ended up there intentionally, but the rumor mill said otherwise, and the Army Air Force's leadership, particularly General Arnold, who was the head of the Army Air Forces, thought that this rumor was so incendiary that even after they investigated and debunked it, he classified it top secret because it was so damaging to the United States morale that he didn't want it to feed into enemy propaganda, if that makes sense.
It does, and it takes until, sometime in 2013 that Congress takes some action to recognize some of these interned airmen. Tell us what happened that year.
Well, it was more of a 15-year effort for me. So I started the research on my grandfather when I was still a cadet at West Point, and I just pulled his records from Switzerland, and I had all these military tribunal files in French showing that he was, you know, punished for this escape attempt, and then the U.S. legation eventually assisted him in escaping a second time in January of 1945. And so he did get out after about 10 months. And I was fascinated. I tried to apply for the Prisoner of War Medal for him. It can be awarded posthumously. There's no time limit on it. You either qualify or you don't. But his case was a gray area because of the fact that he was held by a party other than a party we were actually in a conflict with. And I had looked up the law because, you know, I tend to look up the regulations before I send off paperwork for that sort of thing. And it seemed to allow this circumstance. There was an exception written into the law in 1989. It was an amendment, and I figured this out later why they did this, but I didn't know at the time. It allowed the military secretary concerned to waive the combat criteria in cases where the treatment was bad enough to make their experience substantially equivalent to what prisoners of war went through. And I later pulled all the legislative history and I discovered they had enacted this amendment because when they had first passed the law, they never realized that they were writing out any kind of hostages, detainees, or in this case, internees, all of whom were not actually in a conflict. And obviously, contemporary conflict is often against non-state actors. And ironically, if you're not in a declared war, and we've subsequently declared war on terror, you know, whatever that means. But in reality, you can't really declare war on an ideology. It has no meaning structurally. And so these laws had intended declarations of war or at least a joint resolution for use of military force in the modern context against the state. And so this early law that they had enacted did not allow people like the Iran hostages who were egregiously mistreated. The Pueblo crew that was taken captive in North Korea in the late 60s, people like Gary Powers, who was held in the Soviet Union, and various military attachés that had been abducted by terrorist forces throughout the years, they all, in some cases, had been significantly mistreated, tortured, executed, you name it, probably in some cases on average worse than prisoners of war, depending on the conflict that you're comparing it with. And yet they were deemed not to qualify for this medal because we didn't have a declared conflict. And that wasn't the purpose of the decoration. The purpose was to recognize the person's sacrifice on duty, you know, in the hands of somebody who wanted to mistreat them. And it didn't necessarily have to be incident to a war. And so I realized very quickly that the interpretation of this law was skewed. And it turns out that the regulations had never captured that amendment. And so they were still cycling policy that harkened back to the original law that required a conflict. And I invoked this exception. I said, well, this law very clearly supersedes your regulation. The law allows a particularized case-by-case analysis to waive this conflict. And I have the evidence. I have evidence these men were mistreated. I mean, I guess you could argue they weren't mistreated enough, but that wasn't the argument. The argument I received from both the Army, Air Force, and the Office of the Secretary of Defense was that they were simply ineligible by law for consideration.
Well, it's an interesting...
And I knew that...
I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're going to run out of time
sure.
here. And you told me at the beginning I would have to do this because you get so passionate.
It's fine.
You get so passionate on it, so I appreciate that, Dwight. We're talking to Dwight Mears, who's a retired Army major, who went through West Point and along the way picked up his PhD, his JD. He's taught history, and he got into this issue because of his grandfather. It's a fascinating issue, and you can see how it echoes through the decades, right? As you point out, it you know, as written, it didn't apply to hostages, detainees, internees, and you're identifying some in every decade where, hey, this doesn't really make sense in this context. So it's a fascinating, if people wanted to know more about this issue and read some more about this issue, Dwight, what would you recommend that they turn to?
Well, there's quite an exhaustive explanation of the statute on Wikipedia. It's Title 10, Section 1128, POW Medal. And I wrote a peer-reviewed article specifically on the internee's ineligibility for the POW Medal in the Journal of Military History a few years back. And the title of that was The Catch-22 Effect. I thought it was... very interesting that Joseph Heller, the author of the Catch-22 novel and you know, was later adapted into a movie, and I think is now a series on Hulu or HBO. I think they've readapted it. Interestingly, he picked up on the actual rumors from his own service in World War II on these aircraft. And so he was repeating real rumors, just like the ones I mentioned were held against these internees and actually reinforced them.
And another place that you and I talked about before we started is that probably if you went to Google Scholar and put in Dwight S. Mears and dissertation and internees, you'd probably pull up your original work in the dissertation. So we just wanted to give some folks who might have heard this and said, this is an interesting piece of history I've never thought about, or I had a family member involved in, kind of where they might turn to get some more information. We're out of time, and I want to thank you, Dwight Mears, Major, for spending some time with us today on Veterans Radio.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a Veterans Disability Lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.